Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. This is News Talk.
You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up this morning, Jamie Crawford on being diagnosed with MS at 32 and how this helped him years later when his wife Georgie was diagnosed with breast cancer at the same age. Chef Ben Whale discusses his menu favourites from the Body Camp Ibiza, a fitness and wellness retreat that's just reopened its doors. And I am heading also to the Axe Club in Dublin to see if I could represent Ireland at the next World Championships of Axe Throwing. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, it was good. I completed my 12-kilometre run for Together Apart We Run, the virtual race. It's 21 kilometres backwards. Obviously, I felt a pang when I saw the half marathon runners posting their social media pages and tagging Together Apart We Run. But look, we are where we are. And my husband was away, so my sister had the kids while I headed off. And when I came back, they had a finish line, balloons. Again, kind of wish I had run further, especially when all our neighbours were coming out asking if I'd just ran a marathon. But look, a win is a win, and getting the runners on and going any distance is a win. And look, my sister is always my number one supporter. Now, several of you have emailed me during the week. I always welcome all your emails, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, asking for my thoughts on recent articles by Joe Brolly. Joe is a trained barrister. He's also a GAA analyst and a writer. And he's had a couple of articles in The Independent about the credibility of healers and the wellness industry. Now, much as I am an avid supporter of health and wellness, that's obvious, I do think he raises some excellent points. I do think we need to be careful about who we lay our trust in and, more importantly, who we give our money to. The wellness industry is without regulation, and that's not to say that it's not filled with fabulous, well-intentioned people, but you do need to be cautious and always favour evidence-based research in your health and wellness advisors. That said, I do think it's all relative. Where people are in their life, what they've had going on that can lead them to seek alternative therapies and wellness endeavours. I mean, I always give the example of going to a slimming club years ago, and there are lots of people in the health industry who are critical of those kind of clubs. I do think a lot of them have redeveloped their plans over the years since I was there and are now more about educating people on the right calories rather than a simple message of just reducing them. But my point is, there were people at that slimming club who, when a butternut squash was held up, didn't know what it was and were fascinated to learn that they could roast it and blend it with some stock and make a really healthy low-calorie soup. So for me to then hear a trainer say it's wrong, and when they head on the scales they could be losing muscle and there's more than that they could do, it doesn't take into account the spectrum people are on. And maybe that slimming club is a starting point for people. And likewise, Joe Brolly's article calling out life coaches, I agree with him that we have begun to cultivate a culture where being average and getting by is considered a negative, and we're all supposed to be striving to be the best and have more, which kind of suggests that what we've got going on isn't always enough. But Joe Brolly, I don't know him, I've never met him, I don't know everything about him, but he seems to have a well-established career. He's not afraid to have an opinion, which would lead me to believe that he's fairly comfortable in his own skin. And not everybody feels that way, which is why many turn to coaches and healers and all sorts to try and find a way. And many get great comfort and help when they find themselves in front of the right person. I did, of course, consider asking Joe to be a guest on the show, and he would be very welcome at any time. But I don't feel the need to try and convince him of another point of view. As I said, he's many valid points and is as entitled to ask questions of the wellness industry as anyone is and should. So the next thing that caught my eye this week might make Joe Brolly shudder is a podcast with Oprah Winfrey and Deepak Chopra. Now, he is a trained physician, and 5 years into being chief of staff in a US hospital, he became interested in meditation and he changed course to more alternative therapies. He's now written 80 books on the subject of spirituality and is worth an estimated $150 million. So do with that what you will. But it was an interview with him and Oprah, and it was something Oprah said at the start of the interview that really made me think. She was talking about meeting a yoga expert who made her do an exercise which changed how she viewed our thoughts forever. So I'm going to do it to you now. So unless you're driving, you have to close your eyes. And I want you to picture three objects and then let them go as I go through the list. So the first is a full moon, an oak tree by the bank of a river, and a red triangle. So if you've done that and let them go, the point of the exercise is that you, as an observer of those three pictures, the oak tree, the red triangle, the full moon, is the same observer of all the thoughts that flow through your head every day. And just as you can let those pictures go, you can let the thoughts go too. You are not your thoughts is something that's bandied around in wellness all the time. And it's really hard to get your head around. Whereas this shows you that you can be in control of your thoughts, not them be in control with you. I'm still a little bit in the mind blown stage of that whole exercise. What I'm going to do with it, I don't know. But I wanted to share it with you and see what you had to think about it. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
The Body Camp run fitness retreats in Ibiza, Mallorca and the UK. And it looks like for this year at least, I might have to experience it through Instagram only. And aside from looking at the toned bodies, the long timetable and the gorgeous sunsets, I'm always drawn to the food that gets posted. We're always told that you can't out-train a bad diet and nutrition is essential, an essential cog in the health and wellness wheel. Ben Whale is the man in the Body Camp kitchen. After 18 years as a professional chef, he retrained in nutrition and now serves up plant-based dishes to those transforming themselves at the camp. He's on the line from Mallorca now. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
Sitting in the sunshine as we speak.
I am. And a little bit of shade because it is quite hot at the moment. But, you know, I can't complain.
And you've just recently reopened to guests post-COVID. So how's all that been?
Yeah, really good. Well, we've been doing, because obviously Germany and the local people on the island, their borders are open first. So we're doing little sort of private ones for there. But now we, well, now when the British borders were open, or the corridor, we had an influx. So we were full and now it's gone a bit funky again. So it's not as busy, but it's actually really good. Really good. People are loving it, so.
So tell us a bit about the Body Camp then. It's your sister Kate. She's the woman at the helm of it.
So she's the founder, as it were.
And you and her grew up on a farm. So were you always in this kind of, was this path inevitable when you look back?
I guess so. I mean, we've always been into the farm. And then we lived in a pub as well as kids. So we've always kind of been in that food, like knowing where the food's come from and sort of the entertainment side of it as well. I always used to help my dad in the kitchen. So I always used to chop up all the vegetables for Sunday. I mean, he gave me my first knife. I think I was like 5 or 6. And I'd chop up carrots and rumble the potatoes for a potato rumbler. So it was always kind of part of parcel and sort of progressed from there, I guess.
And did you always see the link between health and food?
Not at the start. I mean, I was always quite fortunate. We always, well, now I look back, we ate reasonably healthy. But now as I sort of progress through my career, I mean, my diet before as a normal chef, I call him a normal chef, was awful. I mean, I would sort of be picking all the food and then I'd eat loads of burgers and fish and chips when I finished, or fried chicken and loads of stuff, really. And then I got more interested in, when I was in London, actually, I was a bit miserable of the grey weather. It was summertime and it was just raining. I was like, sod this. I'm going to go to Ibiza. And I started working on a health and fitness retreat there. And that's where it really opened my eyes. I was like, okay, this is what it's about. Not what I was doing before.
And so when you retrained, what did you look at and what did you learn?
Well, I sort of self-taught a lot of it to start with. I was like, okay, well, let's look at cutting out loads of saturated fats. I still viewed meat as still quite a healthy food. And then I kept going to different courses, different conferences, doing more sort of alternative nutrition courses as well, that were looking at the benefits of a plant-based food and plant-based diet. So people like Dr. Greger, Dr. Dean Ornish, Dr. Clapper, who were like the sort of godfathers of the plant-based movement, I guess. And they were showing the effects of how switching over to a more plant-based diet actually really has amazing effects on your body, especially if you've got things like heart disease or if you're overweight, or controlling sort of diabetes as well is really helpful.
And you regularly attend the LA Plantrician Project. Tell us about that and the kind of things that you've learned there.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, so every year they do it in LA, or this year was actually last year, sorry, in September, was in San Francisco. So they do it all over the world, but that's the sort of the main one that's the best go-to, basically. There's about 1,000 people there. 95% of them are doctors and cardiologists and nurses and dietitians, or sort of basically kind of retraining, as it were, or basically are getting a bit more expertise when it comes to food, because a lot of the time these people are treating symptoms, not getting to the cause. I mean, I can't even know where to begin, really. You learn so much from that course. So you've got all the cardiologists who, like Dr. Dean Ornish and Dr. Clapper, who show you all their results from the people they've worked with, reversing diabetes, reversing heart disease, working with people who are really, really sick and basically knocking on death's door, who could barely walk from like 50 meters or so without getting a sort of tight chest or feeling out of breath, to the point where they're doing marathons and doing all sorts. It's really incredible, really inspiring.
So then you want to get back into the kitchen, and then you have people coming to the body camp who quite a lot of the time I see are already rather well informed when it comes to health and fitness anyway, and this is just their kind of holiday. Do you have other people who come and it becomes the change for the rest of their lives? Do they transform their way of thinking? Is it the starting point of that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, for some people it's a bit of a top up, but for a lot of people as well, it's a catalyst to transform their lives. So they just go to get to a point where it's like, right, something's got to change because the way I'm living isn't doing it for me. So, I mean, obviously I'm biased. I mean, the food obviously is great, but it's not just about the food. It's also about the mindset. So we do a lot of mind work here as well. Rick, our head coach, is brilliant. So, and Anthony as well. So they do a lot of mind work right at the beginning to get you in that right sort of mind frame. So sort of reframing. So when you're doing an exercise and your muscles feel sore, well, we do a thing called a reframe, where we're saying, oh, I'm feeling really sexy today as opposed to sore. So it's just little changes to your mindset and the way you talk to yourself makes a huge impact on people's health and their results as well. But yeah, we get people of all sorts of fitness and all walks of life.
And are you noticing a change when it comes to the food in the people that come? Do less people look for meat now than, say, 5 years ago?
Oh, definitely, 100%. Even myself. I mean, I think it's, as long as people are eating like tasty food, they don't really miss anything. But if you just gave someone like just a salad with some lettuce leaves and a bit of dressing, they'd be like, okay, this is not so great. But here we're mixing it up. We're doing lots of like, we do sort of aubergine and tofu meatballs. We do things with tempeh. I mean, we do buddha bowls. I do like a cheesy chili polenta cake with loads of like Joe tomatoes from the island. And it's just about being, not to say really creative, but just putting a bit of variety on your plate. And people don't miss it. As long as they're eating good food, they actually really, really enjoy it and embrace it very much so.
You're listening to Alive and Kicking on News Talk with me, Claire McKenna, and I'm talking to Chef Benjamin Whale about what he serves up at the Body Camp Ibiza and Mallorca. I'm not 100% plant-based by any means. I just try and eat as many fruit and veg and pulses as I possibly can.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
I'd miss fish. I think I live too close to a harbour. But we'll see. But what even with that framing in mind, and I've, you know, seen this, the kind of people that you're talking about, like Dr. Michael Greger and the advice that's been given. So even with all that in my mind, there's times I think if you're going to be doing lots of exercise, plant-based isn't going to be enough.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, to be honest, none of us, apart from my sous chef, are vegan. So I'm not 100% plant-based myself. I mean, I'll eat meat or fish maybe 2-3 times in a month. Even the blue zones around the world, the people who live like over 100, who are fit 100-year-olds, they eat a bit of meat or fish about 4-5 times a month max. So, but in here, it's all about, a lot of people have a bit of a stigma of plant-based food is not enough. The thing is, to a certain extent, it is true to a certain extent, because it's trying to get it into you, basically, because it's not as calorically dense as, say, meat and cheese and all that sort of stuff as well. So you have to sort of mix it up with a few more nuts, a few more avocados, maybe like a cheeky shake here and there. But that's more for the guys, actually, who are trying to bulk and who have got lots of muscle density. I find that most people, like normal people, a plant-based diet is more than adequate and gives you more than what you need for exercise easily. Again, as long as you're having your pulses, your quinoas, your nuts and grains, like any diet, as long as you're having a good balanced diet, you're going to get what you need, knowing a few little tricks as well. But I always supplement with a smoothie, as it were. I love a smoothie. And you can get loads of good nutrients into that as well.
And your food always looks really pretty. Is that important to you?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, the taste is obviously, it has to taste good. But then if it looks good and tastes good, then it ticks all the boxes, really, doesn't it? I mean, people always, if it doesn't look so great and people eat it and go, well, it didn't look so great, but they always remember that taste, go, wow, that tastes amazing. That's what we're looking for, is the taste. But I mean, people eat with their eyes as well, so it's got to look good as well.
Because sometimes you go to a vegan or a vegetarian restaurant and there's lots of sort of curries or, you know, veg lasagnas and the big bain-maries, and it's all just a bit sloppy and it tastes good and that's great. But yours is very, very, it's like art on a plate. And I, you know, I see videos of you from time to time on Instagram bringing stuff out, and it's quite performance based. Like, you're very proud of what's on that plate, and that's really nice to
definitely see.
Yeah,
well, we've got this big open kitchen as well, and people like to know what's in the food, what's going on with the food, how have we prepared it, what to do. Because that's the thing, because it looks so good. Everyone's like, wow, this looks really cool. It tastes amazing. But a lot of the time, it's actually really simple. We do a couple of little chef-y things where we'll just garnish it, make it look pretty. But as soon as you make it look pretty, it looks complicated. But if you take away the garnishes, it's actually really simple. It's just a couple of little simple dressings. I have a lot of what I call sort of the base recipe, like the mother recipe. So where you have your classic recipe and then you can kind of jazz it up with what you want. So the things like the dressings always go down really well. But curries and stuff are usually quite popular. I mean, I love curry myself. I could eat it at breakfast, lunch and dinner, like no problem. But then I also like, it's quite hot now as well. So it's nice to just get really good, like sources of good ingredients, get it nice and fresh, nice and ripe. And as long as you've got good ingredients, you can't really go wrong.
Sometimes I will admit I look at the size of the dish and I think, oh God, after a day of boot camp on the beach and yoga and hiking and chilling by the pool, would that be enough? Is that because we've lost our way on what proper portion size really is?
Well, not really. I mean, here, obviously, a lot of people actually eat more than they normally would at home because they're having three main meals a day and they're having two treats as well. So, but what we also have, we have a lane system on camp. So it depends on what your goals are when you come here. So you have like a lane one, a lane two, and a lane three. Lane one is portion control, so a bit smaller. Lane two is for people who want to maintain their weight. And lane three is for people who want to bulk. But when it comes to sort of portion sizes, I mean, a lot of the time, I mean, I remember when I was younger, I'd have like a big, like loads, like a Chinese takeaway, for example, eat loads of it, feel stuffed, and then 1 hour later I'm hungry again because your body isn't getting the nutrition that it needs. So we find here with the portions as well, they're quite nutritionally dense. So when you're getting that down, a lot of the time people are actually full. I mean, normally we've got five guys here this week, and they all started off in lane two because they thought, right, we're not going to get enough food. And every single person this week has gone to lane one because they're finding it really filling and satiating. So kind of says, oh, if you get the nutrition onto your plate, then quite often you actually feel a lot fuller.
It's really interesting because there's a lot of fast food places where that would happen as well. You know, you're full and then, you know, you're hungry again because it wasn't nutrient dense, as you say. And you mentioned the treats there, and they're sort of dessert after meals. Are people surprised that sweet stuff, it's a different type of sweet stuff, but that is allowed?
Yeah, we'll actually do a bit of a spoiler alert for anyone who wants to come. I actually do a dessert on the last night, but we have treats. So it could be, I mean, I know the treat is sort of associated with sweet, but we do all sorts of things as well. Like I do a romesco sauce with like crudités, or we do chocolate and salted caramel protein shakes. I've just made a vanilla cheesecake with a salted caramel like glaze, if that makes sense. If you can picture that in your head. It's a little cheesecake with a shiny brown, lovely salted caramel glaze over the top, and I do a cinnamon and buckwheat twill, which is crunchy. So it sounds really unhealthy, but it's actually super healthy as well, but quite calorically dense. So we make little ones of that. So people can be like, wow, is this actually healthy? And like, well, it's healthy if you have a small bit, but obviously if you eat loads and loads and loads of it, it can be quite calorically dense. Like, for example, like one cup of cashews is like 600 calories. So if you are thinking you're healthy, which we are being healthy by snacking on loads of nuts, which a lot of people do, quite often you could be doing a lot of calories as well. So it's just something to be aware of.
Well, you know, I was nodding and smiling at the thoughts of it, as was producer Simon. Hopefully we'll get to come out one day and eat all these things for myself. Living on site like this, Ben, and having all of this going on around you, are you transformed? Are you living your best health and wellness life?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I mean, since I switched over to more plant-based, eating loads of fruits and vegetables and like learning more as well, I my energy levels, my stamina, everything has definitely gone up 100%.
And you're doing a job that you love, and that's what everybody says is the key. Well, exactly. And in the sunshine, what could be wrong?
I know, exactly. I mean, honestly, if I was miserable here, then I would definitely be in the wrong place. And we've got such a great team. I mean, it's easy when you're working with good people as well. The job can be not so great, but if you've got good people around you, I mean, it just makes it everything better, doesn't it, as well? Plus the amazing scenery and the weather, the salt pool that you can jump into. I mean, you'd be a fool not to enjoy this, really.
Well, if you want to find out more, you can go to thebodycamp.com. There's also a book, The Body Camp Food Bible. Chef Ben Whale, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, I head to the Axe Club in Dublin to see if I could possibly represent Ireland in the next World Championships of Axe Throwing.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
So before the world changed back in March, I saw a tiny article in one of the papers about axe throwing as an interesting way to exercise and have fun with your mates. And the Axe Club, with venues in Dublin and Wicklow, was hugely popular for corporate team building groups, hens, stags and birthday parties. So I finally got to go along to the Dublin venue to meet Matt Lavelle this week. And here's how I got on. I'm in a warehouse is all I can describe it, which it's not just a warehouse because it's been completely remodeled by Matt Lavelle of Axe Club. Matt, hello.
Hi, welcome to the club.
So this is one of your lairs. You also have an area down in Wicklow that's a bit more of an outdoors experience.
Yeah, there's two venues what we use. One is here in Dublin, which is central Dublin venue. It's kind of nondescript warehouse that's done out, like a kind of lumberjack lounge. It's loads of wood, plenty of places to sit down, a nice big space so everyone can maintain their social distance. And our other venue is down in Lara in the Wicklow in the woods. It's right beside the Avonmore River. It's beautiful, dappled sunlight, plants are growing, loads of birds. It's amazing.
Well, we can tell by your accent you're not from Wicklow or Dublin. What brought you to these parts?
I am definitely not from Wicklow. Or Dublin, but my partner's Irish from Rathmines, and so we moved over here 3 years ago now and started up Axe Club. We also teach sort of bushcraft and survival things, and that's how I got into the axe throwing, was through teaching those things.
I've never even heard of axe throwing until I saw a very small piece in the corner of a magazine, and I thought that'd be a good thing to do for Alive and Kicking. But what is it? How did you get involved in it?
Good question. I got involved by mistake, and so I started teaching bushcraft and survival with a guy called Heath Dawson down in Wicklow. He does a lot of teaching of that kind of thing. He's a real expert. So I kind of latched onto him, and he invited me one evening and said, "Do you want to come axe throwing?" And it's the kind of offer you can't really say no to. It just kind of grabs you. So I said, "Yeah." And off we went into the dark woods with some floodlights and a big round of wood. And through axes, and I was hooked ever since then. It's brilliant.
So let's walk and talk as we go, because you can show me round here a little bit, because everything is sort of back to nature. Like, you've drawn trees around the outside, there's a lot of wood around, because is that what axe throwing is part of?
Axe throwing is about splitting wood, mainly. So when you throw it, it sticks in and splits the wood, but all the wood comes from nature. Everything is from the trees. So we try and sort of recreate this kind of countryside, relaxed lumberjack feel in the middle of the city when you're surrounded by all of this grey concrete, tarmac roads everywhere, and you come inside in this small little nondescript warehouse which just looks like nothing from the outside, and you come in and it's just completely transformed, and so people find wood very relaxing and tactile.
And this warehouse you used to come to, it was a brewery, and you used to come and do axe throwing meets here.
Yeah, so we used to come and they would do a corporate beer brewing event, and there's a lot of waiting around in beer brewing, so in the gaps between while they're adding one thing or another, we would do a little bit of axe throwing in the gap just to kind of fill the space and make the event slightly more exciting. So we'd do that, and then we took on the lease about 2 years ago, and it's now Dublin's only central axe throwing venue.
And tell me what we've got around here. Talk us through it. Let's bring the listener on the tour.
So once you come in the door, we sign a disclaimer and make sure everyone's safe. We do a safety briefing, etc. But the space itself, there's loads of cut logs, lots of natural bark and timbers, a few rugs around the place. And we've got a small communal fire for everyone to gather around. It's not a heating fire, it's more of an aesthetic fire. It looks beautiful. We've got an axe club bar there where people can, pre-COVID times, we could have tea and coffee there, and we'd also do pizzas and stuff pre-COVID times. There's lots of places for people to sit down and relax.
And it's quite Game of Thrones in ways, like you've got rugs and sort of throne-like areas. There's a few Viking helmets, like it's all very
Yeah, we've got some nice soft natural textile materials too as well. So there is some like lumberjack stuff, but there's also some nice soft sheepskins to sit on. There's a reindeer skin over there from Sweden, which I picked up when I was doing the axe throwing competition over there for the World Axe Throwing Championships.
So you have done this competitively. So from that night when you went out in the dark, things changed.
Yeah, it did. I was kind of hooked. And so I went out, I think about a week later, and bought my own axe. So once I'd got my axe, I just went again and again. And we kind of formed, myself and Heath and a few other people formed the Wicklow Axe Throwers. There's about 17 or 20 of us or so. A merry band of brothers, men and women, all throwing axes, and we compete in the UK championships, in the Nova Scotian championships, in Canada, Sweden championships, German, etc. So we travel all over and compete. It's deadly.
All right, well, I give it a go then. So how do I know what the right axe is for me? Will I feel it in my soul?
You won't feel it in your soul. I shall hand it to you.
Okay. So these are very different to a normal axe, or is this something you'd pick up in your hardware store?
This is a completely normal axe. It's right. A hatchet you can pick up in Woody's or anywhere like that. It's a very normal hatchet. It weighs about 800 grams. They're not that sharp. They don't need to be that sharp, with a hickory handle. So it's what you'll be using, splitting wood for your fires.
Okay. And there was a few health and safety pointers on your website, which, you know, I think are worth pointing out because I wouldn't have thought of them. You don't recommend people bring their own axe. You supply axes here. That's obviously safe. And no flip-flops or open-toed shoes. And I might not have thought of that, but, I mean, the reason is quite clear.
Well, nobody wants an axe dropped on their toes. So, yeah.
So I'm in my trainers. I'm here. I'm ready. So talk me through some pointers. Let's see a master at work.
Well, if you're right-handed, you hold the axe right at the bottom of the axe with your other hand on top. And your feet kind of shoulder-width apart, round about 15 foot away when you start off. We can adjust your distance as we get going. One hand on top of the other. And then you let the axe go back over your head.
So you're holding it with two hands, but then you're letting go. Okay.
Oh, no, we do hold it with two hands. I'll just... don't want to knock the microphone.
Okay, now. Okay. Yeah, no, I don't want to get my head chopped off either. All right, so you're holding it with two hands.
Two hands, and then you bring the axe back as if you're scratching your back, right the way back over your head, and then you step forward, and as you step and throw, and you release at about 11 o'clock.
So you
not
didn't,
so perfect. Not
you
the
didn't hit the bullseye with that one.
I didn't, but this one will.
Whoa.
So we teach people the two-handed method rather than the one-handed method like I used just there. The two-handed method has allowed people to get their central alignment right.
Okay.
It stops you twisting your wrist off.
Okay, so that teaches you. And then do I move on to single you hand could, throw?
Some people prefer one-handed, some people prefer two. It's a total mixture. We always start with two, and then people can try their own style with one or two hands, whichever they prefer.
Okay, well, can we swap weapons then? I'll give you the microphone, you give me the axe, and look, I'll give it a go. So how far back am I? We're actually closer than I thought.
Yeah, there's two black lines on the floor. There's one at 12 foot and one at 15 foot. And it creates a black box on the floor, and the rule is you throw from the black box. So 1 foot has to be in it, and you can't put your foot over the front line.
Okay.
Because what happens is if you get too close to the target, the axe can bounce back.
And you have six targets here. So can you have six people throwing at once? Does that get a bit hairy?
No, it's fine. Everyone throws at once and collects at once. And the instructor has kind of full control of it. They say collect or throw. We've been throwing axes since 2010, and we've had no issues whatsoever. It's completely safe.
All right, so...
Bring it right back over your head.
Back as if I'm scratching my back,
that's it.
As you said.
And as you step forwards and release at the same time.
On my left.
So step with your left
I'm throwing
foot.
With my right, so I'm going to step with my left. And I can't go past the black line, is
that's
that right?
That's it, yep. Just a good strong step and throw. Excellent. So that went right over the top of the range into the bit of the back.
How many axes are back there?
That's where we keep the small children. And fluffy pets back there.
Okay, sorry.
No problem.
But we'll take two. So where did I go wrong there, Matt?
Hard to tell. But basically, your first throw, all we're looking for is the axe goes forwards.
Okay.
Because you've never thrown an axe before. You don't know what it's like. You just need to have a go. So we don't offer too much for the first couple of goes. Just go again. See okay. how it feels. Put one hand on top of the other.
Oh, yeah.
But right at the bottom there. That's it. And okay. go for it. Just see what happens. Great. Well, that's forward. It went forward.
Too low. This
too low.
Too low.
We're making progress.
This one's got to be just right.
So come a little bit further back. Put your balls of your feet maybe on this black line, the back black line.
Okay.
And then there's a white axe on the floor, which is in the middle of the box. So as you bring your axe back, step onto the white axe and throw. That's it. Fantastic.
Okay, that went in.
That's in. If you
that
could see this,
better.
It's not the bullseye, but it is in
it's
the
not
scoring
on
zone.
The board. It is in the scoring zone, is it?
It is in the scoring zone, yeah. So we've got six in the middle, four, three, two, one. We don't know where the five went. It's got lost, so it's...
Okay, and why do you get 10 for the outside?
Those green dots at the top,
yeah.
They are called the Eye of the Tiger. Or the clutch in America, they've got a slightly different system up there, and you score 10 for those. So you have to get it into those green dots.
Okay.
So you've got a red bullseye in the middle, black rings around the outside, and then some small green dots, which are like extra bonus points.
I'd like to see you hit a green dot, the Eye of the Tiger there, please. And can you do like two at once and hit both eyes? Is that the double axe throwing situation?
No, I can't do that, but some people can. If you look on Instagram for axe throwing, there is loads of mad stuff out there. People throwing five axes in one hand, one up, one upside down, one the right way up. All sorts
wow.
of people flicking it with their feet, balancing it on their finger, all sorts of mad stuff.
Okay, good stuff. So you're going to go for the Eye of the Tiger, the 10s at the top.
Okay.
All right, Godspeed. Ooh, straight in there, left eye.
Laser focus.
It is actually enjoyable. And sometimes, you know, you'd hear things about corporate nights out and you'd think, like, you know, do people really need to gather around our axe throwing to get on better the following day in the office 9 to 5? But actually, I can see how this builds a bit of camaraderie and you're trying something new and you're saying, how did you get on and what did you score? And there is something about... Playing is essentially what we're doing. We're playing a game.
It's brilliant. It is like, it's the perfect leveler because no one's done it before. Well, very few people have done it before. So the highest executive down to the lowest person in the company, they're all at the same level when they walk in the door. No one's done it. And you pick it up really fast, a really steep learning curve. It's quite hard to get really, really, really good, but you can pick it up and get scoring really fast. So everyone is competitive. You know, when you go bowling, there's always that one person who just gets strike after strike, and then there's someone who can't do it. We've never had anyone that can't do axe throwing. So anybody can do it. Come on! Oh, she looks so angry.
If that had have gone in, that would have been really good.
If you aim generally at the target, generally over here, the axe will generally go over here. If you focus and aim at one tiny little white dot in the middle of the bullseye, a teeny little splinter, then your aim is reduced. They say it in archery, aim small, miss small. So try that.
Mm-hmm.
Try super laser focus
okay.
on a tiny little dot somewhere, right in the middle, okay. and see if you get a bit closer.
It's a good lesson for life, isn't it? Okay.
No bell.
No bell.
But come again.
And you know, I can feel how it is... addictive.
Yeah.
Like you could quite happily spend an hour doing that, potter over here, sit by the fire, What is the situation now with COVID and everything? When do you think you're going to be back to that level, or what are you up to at the moment?
At the moment, we've got a reasonably large space, so we can have 20 people or so in here, and they can all maintain their social distance. We can have the fire on as well. We just can't do food and drinks at the moment. Our normal group size is sort of a maximum of 60, but that's too much at the moment. So soon we'll be able to open to full capacity.
All right, so where can people find out more?
Head to axclub.ie. We've got events every weekend here. It's €25. Just book an hour session. Come along, bring your mates. Be the axe champ. Be awesome.
Matt, thank you so, so much. So yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed that. The setup is incredible. You would have great fun there with some friends. The axe throwing is weirdly addictive, and Matt is just brilliant. A big ball of positive energy in a 6'3" body. He's very passionate about what he does. He's good fun. And I'm definitely going to head down and bring the kids and another family to do the outdoor version. Chop some wood, whittle some sticks and sit by the fire after the woodland walks and all that. So who knew that that would be something I'd add to my to-do list, but it's really good stuff. As he said, for more, go to theaxclub.ie. Coming up after the break, I'll be joined by Jamie Crawford to talk about being diagnosed with MS at 32 and how he lives with it and thrives.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
So I got to know my next guest, Jamie Crawford, when we worked together at Dublin radio station Spin 103.8. He went from my colleague to my boss, and I would hope now that I could call him my friend.
Absolutely.
Depends on how the questioning goes, I suppose. And I've invited him on the show today because recently he revealed publicly on his wife Georgie's podcast, The Good Glow, that he has been living with MS, which he was diagnosed with at the age of 32. Jamie, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And you say, or I say, publicly announced, but it wasn't just the listeners of The Good Glow who were finding out. You had kept it in quite a tight circle. There was a lot of people close to you that didn't know this news either.
Yeah, some of my really, really close friends didn't even know. And I guess the reason for that was because I didn't know what my course would be and where I would end up. And I was kind of a bit afraid of it. And I was also a little bit, I guess, ashamed that this had happened to me, because I had been in this, go mode for my whole life, done really well, thankfully, very lucky to do well in my career. I was very career focused, very sort of wanted to get to the top, and I didn't want people to perceive me differently. So I kind of just said, OK, I'll tell a few people who may sort of figure it out, or figure out that there was something wrong with me because they know me so closely. And then everyone else, hopefully if I can keep it at bay or manage it well, no one else will ever need to know. And that's how I felt at the time, but not now. I suppose my mindset about the whole thing has changed a lot.
And, you know, like, I've thought about that, and it's not a weakness to talk about it. It's not that anyone would think any less of you, but it would change everything. And you do get that face, don't you? That, how are you?
Yeah.
Whereas you got to still have the crack with your mates, and nobody really knew what was going on. And maybe you wanted to keep that going as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, if you remember yourself back to when we were in Spin, we were having great fun, working really hard, but having great fun as well. And I didn't want to lose that, or I didn't want people to sort of feel different about me, or feel sorry for me, or say, oh, Jamie, you shouldn't come to the night out, or, you know, do this, you know, go to the festivals, or maybe, you know, I didn't want any of that. So I wanted just everyone to perceive me the same way that they did, which was their boss, but also their friend, because we had that relationship in Spin. But also, and then, yeah, not to maybe look down at me or just feel sorry for me. I would hate that today if anyone felt sorry for me, you know, that kind of way.
Whereas so. Now you've emerged this strong guy who's running up the Alps. We'll get more into that later. Yeah. Georgie's biggest supporter. And you're like, and by the way, I've had MS. So you've come out sort of like the Hulk or something.
Well, I don't think that I'm like the Hulk, but I'll take that compliment from you, Claire. Yeah.
So let's go back a little bit then. What were the symptoms that you were experiencing that led to the diagnosis?
Yeah, so it was back in February 2012. I woke up one morning. I had no symptoms. I was definitely at that time quite stressed, quite pressured, and probably that was my own detriment that I was feeling that way, because I was quite a control freak, you probably remember as well. I wanted to be involved in everything. I wanted to know all the decisions that were happening in work, outside work and all that sort of stuff. I had some stuff going on as well. So very stressed, very pressured. Wasn't sleeping great. Woke up one morning, my hand was numb, but I kind of didn't really think about it because I had woken up that morning and I was kind of leaning on my elbow and sending texts and doing emails as I did first thing in the morning, every morning, 7 o'clock when I woke up. And then I went down, I remember going down for breakfast and being like, God, you know, it's half an hour later, my hand is still numb. Why is it so numb? And then by the end of that day, I could feel up to my elbow had kind of gone a bit numb, like up around my forearm. And then I just sort of started feeling this kind of tingling in my face then towards the end of the day. And I put my hand on my face to touch it and feel it, and I couldn't really feel my face. And anyone, like, it's hard to describe the symptoms of MS. It's not pure numbness as if you've been anesthetized, or it's more, it's almost like the feeling of wearing a rubber glove on your hand. So when you go to touch the outside of the rubber glove, you can kind of still feel it, but it just does not feel the same. So that was the way my hand and my face felt at that time. And I kind of ignored it, and we went to one of our colleagues' weddings the next day and, you know, had a good night, but wasn't feeling myself. I went to bed early that night, left it for the, you know, about a week or so. I remember saying it to my dad. My dad was always very health conscious, and he's like, go to the doctor straight away. There's no point in not in leaving this. I know you feel a little bit better now, but go to the doctor. And at that point, by the time I got the appointment with the doctor, the symptoms had gone and I felt fine. And my doctor, literally, you know, old school, you know, Dublin doctor, he was like, well, it's either MS, you've had a stroke, or it's nothing. It could be a migraine. I kind of like obviously fell off the bed then, but I really appreciate his honesty. The one thing he said to me was, he didn't talk about the stroke piece. He's talked to me a lot about MS. He said, well, look, if it is MS, I have patients who's in her late 70s still coming to me. I diagnosed her 35 years ago, you know, and that gave me, I was like, okay, well, if it is that, that stuck to me throughout the whole thing then.
So when you got the diagnosis, what did you know about MS, or what were you told? Like, what is it?
Nothing. So I knew a little bit. A guy at the top of our road when I was growing up in Rathfarnham had it, and he was wheelchair bound, and you know, you could, you know, physically he was quite debilitated. But I knew nothing about what actually happens with MS. So to, I guess, to give a quick synopsis of it, it's basically your immune system attacks your central nervous system. So cells attack the fatty sheet that is around your nerves. So imagine this wire here, the plastic that's wrapping up the actual copper wire inside. Your immune system attacks that and basically creates a hole in it. And exposes the nerve. And that's when you start to feel symptoms, because everything is not normal when your nerves are exposed, because the channel or the electric pulse from A to B is getting disrupted by this interruption or this scar, which is ultimately what MS is, multiple scars. So what happens is your body attacks it, you create a hole in the myelin or damage to the myelin, that then your body tries to repair that. But ultimately, like anything, if you cut your hand, you've got a scar on it, it creates a plaque on that. And over time, that builds up and builds up and builds up and can be quite debilitating, as you can imagine. If the attack is in the same place, your body just won't be able to produce any more myelin in order to stop the attack.
But it's quite individual. Each case is very different, and it's hard to know what the prognosis is going to be for each person. So what were you told?
So I was told I had, I went through all the tests and all that sort of stuff, and I was told I had a thing called relapse remitting MS. So I basically relapse and then I go into remission, and I go from relapse to remission. And when you have a relapse, it's when you're having an episode or an attack. But there is another type of MS called primary progressive MS, and that's just very, basically you keep getting attacks and you barely go into remission at all, and that's a much faster course. And over time, relapse remitting MS can become a more progressive disease. So the trick is, in your first, you know, 10 years, is to really manage yourself tightly. It's generally after about 10 years it can start to progress a little bit. So I'm at that peak at that point at the moment right now. So just manage yourself, do everything you can to stay healthy, and obviously take the medication, because I'm on medication now for it.
But you did change the way you were living. Was that on the back of MS and realizing how stressed and busy your life had been?
Yeah. Life was obviously really, really busy. It was all self-inflicted. You know, I wanted to be at the top. I was very, very driven. Pushing myself, you know, working 12, 14
pushing
hours.
Pushing all of us.
Pushing all of you, sorry.
I'm joking.
And working long days and long nights just to get stuff done because I wanted, you know, I'd got a taste of success and I wanted more. At that point, I just said I can, you know, bow down and be, go one way with this or keep trying to achieve what I want to do, but make the relevant adjustments to, you know, facilitate a healthy life as well as a successful life. So, made the adjustments. So diet is a big thing. You know, there's no one silver bullet to like fixing it, but there is approaches that your neurologist tells you and that you can read online about, you know, avoiding certain foods. So like not eating fast food every day, just getting good sleep, eating high omega 3, 6 and 9 foods because that helps the myelin regenerate. Stuff like avocados, salmon, all that sort of stuff. So oily fish. So I've changed my diet massively. And then exercise as well becomes a big part of it.
Well, you're listening to Alive and Kicking on News Talk, where I'm talking to Jamie Crawford about getting a diagnosis of MS at 32 and his life since then. And you mentioned exercise there and you've really taken that on. You've got the running bug.
Yeah, yeah. And so only recently, though, I'll have to say that there's at my wedding, my dad's speech. He started out the speech with Jamie was born running, and all I could hear is everybody from my hockey team laughing because they knew me to not be that person. I hated the physicals. I just wanted to stand in the D and take shots at goal and stuff like that. So they were laughing at me. So yeah, only in the last maybe 5-6 years have I discovered, I guess, a love for running. I couldn't run around the block if you ask me to here. I just can't run on streets or road. It's not really my thing. I don't have the mindset for it. It just gets me. What I do like doing is trail running and being out in nature and I guess experiencing the highs of the peaks in the mountains and the challenge getting up and then the speed of coming down and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's kind of my thing.
And yourself and your wife, Georgie, you went off to the Alps to run. People can see it on the RTE player. It's called Digging Deep. Yeah. And you hadn't announced the MS diagnosis then. So, of course, it's all about Georgie and everything she's overcome coming back from breast cancer and getting to that point.
Yeah.
But it was really emotional for you as well. And then once you announced that, you could really see that you'd both had a health struggle and you'd both come so far. Yeah, so it was an achievement for both of you.
Yeah, no, it was great. And like, to be honest, I didn't even think of going into that. I've sort of parked the MS thing now. Like, I have it, but very much in the back burner of my mind. So that was all about Georgie and I guess, you know, leaning into her achievements, what she's done since then, and her desire to keep exercising, stay healthy and all that sort of stuff. So it was brilliant. At one point in the documentary, I think we were getting ready that morning, I kind of said to her, look, you know, 5 years ago, you would never have dreamed of doing this. She wasn't really into exercising or that kind of stuff. And I had always been. So like, to do that experience was like a dream come true for me to do it with her and to see her excel at it. And actually, she smashed it. I found it much harder than she did. It was great to do it. And hopefully there'll be a few more of those type of things coming up.
And you have been, as I say, her number one supporter. Of course, you would be. But it's interesting. She talks a lot about how you would be there for her in the darkest of days, not just beside her, but that you really studied breast cancer and had all the facts and figures so that when she had a wobble, you were able to say, well, hang on a second, the science says and this says.
Yeah.
And was that because of the experience? Is that what you found helped you get through MS, to educate yourself about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I think that education is, I guess, probably the number one pillar of self-care. And it's a great starting point to understanding your health a little bit better. So really educating yourself. So when I got diagnosed with MS, I spent a lot of time reading about it, not just reading, you know, you can go to Google and read stuff, but you probably need to read the actual medical papers and try and understand them, even though the language used in them can be quite complicated at times. So I spent a little bit of time doing that and understanding how I could navigate the MS. And then, you know, I guess the diagnosis, in addition to that kind of study, had kind of maybe, I suppose, built an operating system in my mind of how to deal with adversity, I suppose. And then, unfortunately, obviously, Georgie got breast cancer a couple of years later. And yeah, for me, then it was like kind of kick in, okay, how do I manage this? And recalling what I had done for myself with the MS and working with Georgie, you know, when she had her dark days and figuring out, you know, her pain points and what was really getting to her and trying to, I guess, maybe coach her on navigating those troubled times, you know, a little bit better.
Yeah, that you'd been through it yourself in many ways. You'd got that shock diagnosis in a doctor's surgery and had to walk on and move on from there. Well, look, you've both emerged from the whole thing stronger and better. It's been very impressive to see. You're taking on a very impressive challenge. Tell us about the run you've got coming up.
Yeah, so I've always needed kind of goals and things to aim towards. So the Arosa Snow Run in the Alps was one big one for me. And then after that, I kind of started to watch a lot of running documentaries and stuff and seeing these guys do these big, big runs. And, you know, as challenging as they are, the feedback that they give after them is that it's like the most amazing experience. So I wanted to do one just with me and my friends. Who are all, you know, they're probably elite athletes. I would not be up at their level, but I said to them, guys, what about we run the Wicklow Way sometime? Maybe try and do it. You know, generally you can walk it in 7 days. We're going to try and do it in about 36 hours. So we'll do day one. We actually had our planning meeting last night. So we'll do day one, probably get about 80, 90 kilometers in, and then leave about 40 or 50 thereabouts to day two. So we'll start on sunrise on Sunday morning the 23rd and try and finish by sunset on Monday the 24th of August. So
127 kilometres in total.
Yeah.
Well, good for you. I mean, as I said, I can't push 12 kilometres myself. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be in beautiful surroundings. Yeah. That's what you like. Yeah. You're going to have your friends around you. So it's going to be a team thing. Yeah. And you're right. When you cross that finish line in Marley Park, that's going to feel incredible.
Yeah, it'll be brilliant. And look, we're doing it for MS Ireland. So I've set up a GoFundMe page for people to support. You know, MS Ireland do great stuff. So I'd like to do something and give back to them to some extent.
But obviously you're talking about it today and turning 40, you decided to just stop it being a secret and get it out there. But you've parked it in your mind. It's not something you think about every day.
No, well, it is something I think about every day, but it's not something I let get to me every day, which was the case for a long time at the start. Like I did, I guess, slump downwards, as anyone does with a significant diagnosis. I was quite low for, you know, a couple of months after the diagnosis. But then I kind of said, look, I can stay like this or I can go this way, and which is what I did. So, yeah, I don't think of it every day. I'm sure if I had symptoms, I'm no symptoms at the moment, I'd be thinking of it. I do have days where I feel, oh, this might be something coming on here. But then generally I've been lucky enough that it hasn't. And my medication is working really well. So I'm happy where I'm at.
Good stuff. Well, continued success to you.
Thank you.
I hope to be there to see you arrive in Marley Park.
I hope you'll be there.
If you want to find out more about MS, you can go to ms-society.ie or you can follow Jamie on Instagram. He's at jamiecrawford11 and you can watch him power through the gorgeous Wicklow trails. And you can find that link to the GoFundMe page as well. Jamie Crawford, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
So that's it from Alive and Kicking on News Talk for this week. My thanks to my producer, Simon Keane, and to Jojo Cordoza, who was on sound. I'll see you next week.